So one thing that I think is interesting about both of you that you have in common is that you were both highly influenced by the writer Philip K. Dick, and it's been interesting to see Dick become posthumously one of the most influential writers of science fiction cinema, his legacy seems to, you know, grow in importance as time goes on. In reading either of you, of course there's ways I can see the influence of Dick, but your work is really so extraordinarily differs from him in so many interesting ways. I'd like to hear some of your reflections on Dick and some of the ways in which I think your mutual interest has even brought you guys together in conversation.
I love the work of Philip K. Dick. He's a California writer, first and foremost, first in Berkeley, then down in Southern California. And he seems to speak to the Californian situation as it being the crazy, surrealistic edge of American culture. And I like the way his protagonists are always ordinary people doing ordinary things and trapped in ordinary problems. And this was really unusual, I think, in the early 1950s science fiction when he began. He took it out of the realm of slans and superheroes and into ordinary Joe Chip, who doesn't have the nickel to get out of his own apartment and has to argue with his door and beg a loan from his door to get out of his apartment in the morning. And this was very attractive to me. Being a Southern California, you know, beach person as I was, it struck a chord of familiarity. And he's a very strong leftist and critic of American capitalism, and a lot of his first novels were anti-McCarthy novels disguised as alien bug from space novels so that he could say all kinds of things about the badness of McCarthyism without ever getting noticed at all by... you know, maybe it's a weakness that he didn't get noticed by anybody at all. But in any case, you had to read through his stories to this political point of view that I was really sympathetic to. And then he turns out to be a tremendous prophet. He's one of those people that could read the culture so that, you know, an actor gets elected governor of California by the support of big corporations, and immediately he writes The Simulacra, like in 6 months later, where Robot is the president and is being programmed by large corporate people in the background. And so he was really quick to use these science fiction symbols to talk about the world that we were living in, but they were really being written at huge speed so that they're a little bit sloppy. Sometimes four or five novels a year, and they have the feel of the world that we're in now. So he had a really good gift for seeing that. So they're good novels, and they're good at culture analysis, I guess is what I love. The most recent thing that I think is actually coming that I used to laugh at as being Philip K. Dick taking it too far is in his novels there are all these flies buzzing around you going, oh, Stan, you need to buy your Frisbee over at my shop. And I was thinking, God, this is such a, you know, the way that satire can exaggerate, how ridiculous can you get? And now we've got these little drones, and for sure they're going to be ads, and that even that is going to come to pass. So the guy was some kind of genius, and... I don't have any impulse to do the reality breakdown stuff that he did. His metaphysics, it's all interesting, beautifully done, but not to my taste. I'm a realist writer myself, and I'm content to say that although the world is mysterious, I think it's actually, you know, fairly there, and it's all we've got. So there's elements of Philip K. Dick that I'm totally uninterested in, and elements that I love, and formally, really good novelist in terms of the limited third-person point of view, following five or six characters around, getting completely inside their heads, and the reader realizing that each one of these persons was so different that the reality that they were combining to create was incoherent and incompatible, because everybody believes their own reality and is stuck in it, but we aren't all the same, and so he's tremendous at that. And I want to hear what Jonathan has to say, but also I want to play this thing of, because Philip K. Dick has about 10 really good accomplished novels and then about 25 broken-backed, quick, rackety messes that are out there, What I like to do, because all you have to do is read them and the division between the two is really pretty straightforward, but I like to hear which one of the weird, crazy novels do you like anyway, even though it's a mess? Because I have a favorite, but I want to wait to hear yours.
Okay. Well, it's so illuminating to hear you talk about Dick's work, Stan, in ways that I think refract through this conversation. It's such interesting and paradoxical ways. And of course, this is continuity for us, because one of the first reasons I became interested in your work was that I knew you'd written about Dick, even before I got a chance to read your dissertation, which was bound and circulated. I know you don't kind of brandish that book, but it's actually still, I think, the sturdiest survey of his entire shelf, or everything that was published to that point. There have been books of his that are published after your survey, but it's such a useful guide to his work. I think it's really interesting to think about the ways in which you describe him. I mean, first of all, you're absolutely right. He, while on the level of the sentences, he was a hurried writer and therefore a very inconsistent one. On the level of novelistic craft, he's an exemplar. And this is said too infrequently because of a kind of embarrassment about his materials that he himself propagated or broadcast. There's this sense that to celebrate him is always to say, well, he's a crazy, messed up, druggy writer of slapdash science fiction, but they're just so great you got to read them. But in fact, he's an exemplary novelist to study for the way he constructs the character systems in the novels, which is one of the things you write about so beautifully in your book on Dick, is the way he would build systems of character organization, you know, the organization of different characters and their relation to one another. It taught me so much to read his books through that lens of your description. But of course, I originally came to him almost with the inverse of your, you know, you were attracted to him as a California novelist while I was living in the East Coast and didn't recognize that he was writing about a real place. And you were attracted to his politics. I took this for granted because I was so deep inside hippie culture that I just thought anyone right-thinking or interesting at all believed that Nixon was a vampire. You know, like that was just, seemed to me, you know, that was like square one for being interested in the first place. I was into the reality breakdowns. I was into him as a surrealist. And to step aside from Dick for just one moment, I think one of the great ironies on the stage, you are a supreme realist. I mean, in some ways, your commitment to the idea of realism outstrips that of anyone working under any label. And yet, of course, you're affiliated with this fantastical tradition, deeply affiliated with it. You win its awards all the time. I found myself with a healthy relationship to the literary mainstream, which was supposed to be, antithetical or allergic to surrealism and the fantastic, but in fact, I'm deeply a surrealist. And the Dick that the Philip K. Dick that I loved first was the surrealist. I just wanted to do that. I wanted my fiction to freak you out the same way that his freaked me out. That was what I wanted. And then I very, very slowly came to become interested in him as a Californian, and I moved to California and was reading Chandler and Ross McDonald, and suddenly I saw them as having a kinship. They were both writing about the undertow of this utopian project here on this coast. And I became interested in him as a social novelist, as someone depicting adult life in its various arrangements and disarrangements. And I grew into an adult life where I could appreciate that aspect of his work. And so now when I read him, I see the social novelist as well as the metaphysician.
Now, what about a favorite one of his cracked books?
Well, I'm not sure we're going to agree on which ones are the cracked ones. I have favorite kind of outré or lesser. I mean, I think the great undervalued novel, but to me, I think it's really one of his great novels, is Now Wait for Last Year.
That was the one I was going to say.
Yeah.
It's true. That is a great novel.
It's a great novel.
And it's not often written about, talked about.
Well, I think...
check that one out.
Yeah.
It's a double recommendation.
Yeah.
So what do you think then about his work as being popular for being transferred into scripts for contemporary movies, which almost, in my opinion, it's hard to see. You know, you see the aspect of Dick in it, but much of what you both just touted as some of his most important attributes.
Well, Jonathan knows more about this world than I do, and I think it might be something that you mentioned to me. It's a Hollywood conservatism or scared that if you can go into a pitch meeting at this point and say, look, it's a Philip K. Dick thing, then you're more likely to get green-lighted. So you just pick any Philip K. Dick novel or short story and say, yeah, it's based on this thing by Dick. And also, you can pitch it. I mean, the idea is often striking. And so I think it's a certain, it's just conservative, fear-based, let's do what's succeeded before. And then
it's like homeopathic medicine. They want a tincture of his work. And it just happens that much more because of the Schwarzenegger movie, to speak of the ironies of the actor governor of California, that film created the prototype, which was, his ideas are just original enough that if you take only that tincture and then build an action movie around it, you've got something. And that's basically what you've seen. Paycheck and even Minority Report. You've essentially got the first idea, and that's why they work from his short stories as often or more often than from the novels, because it's simpler to find the single idea in a short story and not be burdened with the rich characters and the complex metaphysics. And then you take that idea and then you build a star vehicle that's an action film. I mean, this goes also to the wider problem of what has happened to science fiction in the cinema, which is, I think, basically, you know, okay, I'm going to lecture about film here for a second, right? One of the ironies in film is that a lot of bad things start with very good films. And I think after the period of the 60s, when you actually see sometimes people really trying to make serious science fiction stories or ideas into films, and this lasts a little while into the 70s after 2001. I mean, it really only worked brilliantly once, and that's with the Kubrick film. But you see people trying to kind of take what's great about science fiction books and get it into films. But it's a problem because Hollywood is very genre-bound, and the trick to science fiction is that it's not a genre that operates the way they think of genres, like the Western or the film noir. It doesn't have a series of clear operations that you can repeat again and again. The point of science fiction is its unrepeatability. It's different every time. And then, in a weird way, two very good films came along, I think, at the end of the 70s, or in the early 80s. You have Alien, and you have Terminator. They're two really striking films on their terms. Very simple in many ways, but just cinematically sensational films. And they solve the problem of science fiction for Hollywood forever, because the problem is solved. Now what you do is you either make a horror film or an action film. Alien shows you that basically it's secretly a monster movie, and Terminator shows you that basically it's secretly a guns movie. And they're both set in science fiction dress, but you make one or the other. And for the most part, that's been the way the industry has moved forward with science fiction, is to make a monster movie or a guns movie ever since. A chase movie, let's say.
And there is that Philip K. Dick thing of the reality breakdown that is pretty cinematic. When one character that you're seeing on screen and you can't help but believe in it rips their head off and it's another head, a different one, then you have a reality breakdown on screen that is quite violent as a viewer. So some of Philip K. Dick's reality breakdowns are extremely cinematic, and that's
This reminds me, we saw this on a slide earlier today. The great secret of the desire that I think so many of us feel for, let's finally see a Philip K. Dick novel realized on screen. I think that Cronenberg made one without calling it, I think Existence is Ubik. I think it really is as close to the experience of reading a Philip K. Dick novel, and a good one, as film could ever get. I think Existence is the most you could ever hope for in terms of the realization. And I mean, Cronenberg has that impulse in other films. I think there are aspects of both The Fly and Videodrome that are very Dickian. And I think Cronenberg has the good sense, in a way, to stay away from the actual Philip K. Dick properties and just do that stuff under his own banner.
And one more thing that's happening is that really as America as a culture can only really handle one of anything at a time. So we have Einstein, the great scientist. And no, I mean, what about Pauli? What about Dirac? What about all of the other great physicists at the time? Well, no, there's Einstein, right? And nowadays we have Stephen Hawking. So you have Philip K. Dick, and it helps Hollywood producers, and it helps us to think, oh, there was a science fiction writer that was, you know, really good ideas, my lord, interesting. And I still love the idea of somebody who isn't used to science fiction picking up a vintage contemporary version of The Divine Invasion or Galactic Pothealer, one of Dick's crazier books, and trying to read it like you would read an ordinary novel. I hope it blows their minds. But the thing is that 1950s science fiction had Damon Knight, Frederick Pohl, Cyril Kornbluth, Walter Miller, Edgar Pangborn,
Sheckley,
Clifford Simak. It goes on and on. And those guys, and they were mostly guys, but there were a few women there, sometimes disguising their name, Seal Moore, Lee Brackett. In any case, a generation that came before the new wave with all of its modernist pyrotechnics and 60s explosiveness, that were doing really excellent science fiction that Dick fit right in amongst.
It's such a great thing to emphasize, is that he comes out of a context and a milieu. I mean, and this is where the tribalism is interesting, because the writers were speaking to one another explicitly, and they were one-upping each other. They were reading each other, and they were responding. And that kind of, you know, that's so often the lost story in the arts, because of this phenomenon that you just end up with Einstein. You just end up with Picasso. But so much of what happens is people in some kind of dialogue and operation. And yes, Dick may have ended up being kind of the pantheon exemplar, but he so much had a real camaraderie, a real kinship, and in many cases was being schooled. You know, I mean, Sheckley initially was running circles around him, for instance, in the same kind of vein. You know, so.
Well, and we have hope for The Man in the High Castle and playing out in a longer form than
that'd be interesting.
That will be interesting.